the thing about it that I love the most is that, like, music is, makes people's lives better, you know? And I'm helping to represent these friggin' shaman, you know, like, who are healing people and, you know, giving people a good time. And that's, you know, as long as I can ride that wave, I'll do it.
I've probably spent the last 25 years plus traveling around seeing fish all over the country, and went to see them in Europe in the summer of 98. And, you know, I just wanted to see some of these other places. And that really became the, you know, the impetus behind this idea that Larry and I are fulfilling right now.
Here we are with Kevin Calabro, founder of Royal Potato Family, publicist extraordinaire. Kevin has worked with all of, maybe not all, many of your favorite improvisational musicians. He's huge unsung hero of this podcast, gotten a lot of my favorite artists on the show. And Kevin's an entrepreneur. He's deep in this scene we know and love. So Kevin, man, so glad to have you here. Get to pick your brain a little bit. Yeah. How you doing, man?
Doing good.
So starting this off, I want you to take me back to founding Royal Potato Family and just kind of like what that, you know, beginning part of that was like, jumping off the diving board, you know, into that deep end of working for yourself.
Yeah. Well, I had, you know, I just had this like bolt of lightning hit me one day. I think I told you this, but I was on a plane going to Nashville, and it just kind of between working for a label and figuring out what I was going to do next, but still doing like PR and manage some management stuff. And it just like struck me like, you know, there's nobody there to fill that void on the record label side. And you have all this experience. I had all this experience doing it, working for someone, but like, I knew how the business worked top to bottom. So it was like, I should just do it myself. I could, you know, I was able to get distribution. I knew I could line that up. And then at the time, Marco Benevento, he had done Invisible Baby on the label I was working with, Hyena Records. But that had was kind of coming to an end, because the person I got involved, who we started that label with, was Joel Dorn, a record producer who I'd been working with for like 10 years leading up to that. And, but he passed away really suddenly. So I knew what to do to start a label. So then I talked to Marco about it, because he had the Me Not Me record ready, and we were trying to figure out what to do with it. And I was like, let's just, you know, put it out ourselves, but while we're doing it, start a label. And yeah, and he was like, sure, let's do it. He was as into it as I was. And yeah, Me Not Me came out. And then right after that, we put out a Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey EP, put out a Garage Etoile record, put out a Grayson Capps record. And it just like slowly started like snowballing.
I'd love to hear you talk about, like, you know, so you've worked with legends, and, you know, there's certain attributes, traits, characteristics that are like intangible qualities of successful people. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to hear from you, like, what are some common traits you've observed between these artists, specifically the most successful artists that you've worked with in your career?
Wow, that's a tough one. I mean, it kind of goes without saying, but like, no backup plan, no doubt or fear about, I mean, obviously, you know, artists, it's a hard way to live, you know, it's like, you're really putting yourself out there. Financial stability is hard to come by, but like, I guess really the ones who I see make it, like, there's never any other option, you know, like, I think, and then, you know, there's also successful artists who are successful with other things and in business too. But like, for whatever reason, like, the majority of the musicians and artists I work with, like, there's no backup plan, you know.
So when supporting artists, like, that's an interesting position you're in, because you're supporting them, but you're also in a bit of a leadership role. And I'm curious, like, what your leadership style and, like, maybe like your artist management kind of style is interpersonally with the artists.
I am definitely, like, you know, and I could be faulted for this, but I'm definitely, like, you know, I take direction from the artists and follow their vision. I mean, I make suggestions and have ideas, but I'm not someone who, like, rolls up and is like, you know, we're going to work with this publicist, this radio firm, this, well, actually on that side, I do that a little bit, but we're going to work with this, you know, this photographer, this graphic designer. Like, I want to feel like the artist's vision coming through and help them execute that, you know? And there's some managers who work, you know, differently, who are more like definitively like, this is what we need to do. And I don't know, like, I'm just more about like taking the journey, you know, and trying to really let the, like, the artists have their vision come through. And you know what, like, that's another thing about all of the artists I work with. I've worked with other artists who are more malleable and willing to, like, take direction, but I have a very strong-minded group of people I work with who have a very definitive vision for themselves.
You mentioned some of the early work you did with Marco and some of those original releases that kind of, you know, were your early babies, so to speak. What would you say some of your most memorable highlights have been from your career, from getting to work in the music industry, or maybe just things you've witnessed by being in, like, the right place at the right time? Like, looking back, what would you say are some of the most memorable musical or music industry business related moments from your career?
that's so crazy. I brought wheatgrass to Boy George once at a book release party, at like the supper club or something. When, like, in my very first PR job, I spent 3 hours in Dr. John's basement in the Hamptons going through his entire live tape collection.
Ooh.
That had, like, you know, cassettes, DATs, all that kind of stuff, just years and years. God, I hung out with, you know, Hank Crawford and David Fathead Newman, like the two great horn players in the Ray Charles band, like the classic Ray Charles band. I hung out with both of those guys at the same time and got downbeat to do the last interview they ever did together. God, and it could go, I mean, you know, a cover, also involved with Downbeat, a cover shoot for Medeski, Martin, and Wood, you know, like, to be there with those three guys at that time, like, you know, and they, like, they had been apart for a while, and they were kind of getting back together for that Omnisphere record, and just to see that magic between the three of them and witness that up close over, like, a two-hour photo shoot was pretty friggin' amazing. Ultimately, the thing about it that I love the most is that, like, music is, makes people's lives better, you know? And so, I mean, when I'm there with Medeski, Martin, and Wood, and they're doing, you know, and you're seeing, like, whatever, however, 30 years of their interpersonal chemistry, like, just all there, you know, going off. I'm caught up in that moment. But then when I step back, it's like, really, like, I'm helping to represent these friggin' shaman, you know, like, who were healing people and, you know, giving people a good time. And that's, you know, as long as I can ride that wave, I'll do it. As much as I'm like, you know, it's fucking hard, you know. But
so the music industry is competitive, right? Especially being a business person in the music industry.
Yeah.
And I'm curious with you, like, how do you distinguish yourself in the world of publicists? Like, what is that conversation like if an artist asks you that?
I think I've just built up trust with a certain set of writers over years, and they know I'm coming from a they know sort of the stuff I represent. Like, I'm especially right now, like I only will take on like two or three projects a year. I've got artists that I've been representing for years and years now, like the Wood Brothers and like the Grey Boy All-Stars and Carl Denson and Howl and Rain. And I don't like, that's enough. Like, I'm not looking for it. Like, I just want to work with those guys right now. And I think writers appreciate that, you know. I don't know. I'm not sure. Like, the other thing about it is music PR has changed so much. It's like, there used to be publications, you know, and now so much of it is podcasts. And that's great. It's just like the magazines I was talking about earlier, Downbeat and Jazz Times, and they're still great publications. Relics, has never really gotten, Relics has always like just been killing it. And again, gotten better, but there was maybe more issues, there was more publications, the magazines were bigger, there was more space to get coverage. I used to find out about records, and I think a lot of people did, from print media. I mean, I can actually remember like getting a reissue we had worked at the time by a legendary, but a somewhat obscure jazz vocalist, Big Joe Williams. We had got a piece in the Wall Street Journal. And I remember like that day, probably like 700 physical orders came in just like that morning from that piece running in the Wall Street Journal. I've had the same thing happen in years past with NPR when you get like a weekend edition thing. But now it's like you get that stuff and it's like a little ripple, you know, like you don't. And so it's like, clearly people aren't being influenced by music journalism in the same way. And I think that's because most people are scrolling through their Twitter feed. That's why I think it's also become, which it kind of annoys me to be honest, but like, it's like kind of a thing for music journalists to have like a Twitter persona, And I think that's because journalists need to go there to get like, to find people to read what they're writing.
Yeah, and you see the same kinds of things, like looking at this through the perspective of the publications, like how they have to adapt.
Yeah, I have. I mentioned all those publications, they're still doing great work, but like Jazz Times used to be like that thick, and Rolling Stone would like, cover some music that's not just sort of like, really?
Stepping away from like, Wall Street Journal, NPR, just talking to Kevin, with all you've learned and all you've come to know about our jam scene and, being successful in it. I'm curious, like, let's say there's up and coming bands listening to this episode right now, bands who are still, trying to build their hometown fan base, like just still, pulling up their bootstraps. What kinds of marketing promotional advice could you offer like a musician, an artist at that stage in their career?
I think consistency, just something that has some heart and soul in it and is like real, not just trying to be part of the scene or do something like, what their influences do, like something that's a little fresh. But it can be fresh and real and not be like, it could also be like very traditional at the same time. But that's like a more of a stylistic thing, I guess, but just from a marketing side, I think make sure your stuff has a vibe to it, the graphics you're putting out, the social media posts you're putting up, I still do think press is important, and it means something when Relics or Live for Live Music or, you know, whoever gives you some love. Jam Bass, Weird Music Podcast, you know, like, so I'd say, you know, try to get your music in a, you know, and when it's ready to, you know, like when you really feel like this, we've put in the time and this music is the best representation of what we're going to do, like get it to people like yourself, try to just get some name awareness going. Cause I think that's, you know, ultimately it's like when you see a name come across the websites and podcasts you listen to enough times, and then you, you know, maybe you see it on a pop up on your Spotify or Tidal or whatever, or you find it on a, you know, just suggested to you on YouTube. Well, then you're like, okay, I feel like I've been hearing about this. I need to check it out. You know, I think, right? Like I've been doing this for years and I still don't really have the answer. You know, you just have to be consistent, you know, have a vibe, be honest.
Any other general do's and don'ts business advice for any young scrappy musicians out there?
Oh man, I don't know. Just, you know, when you like send your stuff when it's ready and when you have like a good looking link and, you know, just the someplace I can dive into the band easily, check you out a little further. I think that's, you know, rather than like a Facebook link that doesn't like I don't want to get sent to Facebook or even Instagram, really, you know. I want to go to a SoundCloud is good, like a good SoundCloud. Yeah. So
Kevin Calibro, Royal Potato Family, man, so glad to have you here. Hopefully first of many appearances for you.
Yeah.
Big thanks, you know, for all that you do for us, as well as, you know, the scene in general.
Yeah. Same to you. You know, you're covering in cool music and you're young. And that's like, that's the most important thing. It's like, we need your energy. You know, like what you guys are up to in your 20s and stuff. How old are you?
26.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, Kevin, so for any artists out there listening, where can they find you and get a hold of you?
Go to royalpotatofamily.com. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it, everybody. Kevin Calibro, publicist extraordinaire. Clap track. Much love, Kevin.
Much love to you too.
Well, if you made it this far, thank you for listening. Just want to let y'all know we've got these hand-dyed, ice-dyed Weird Music Podcast tees, and we're also going to be making some sweatshirts, so if you'd like one, let us know. We'd love to get you one. Also want to give a big shout-out to the geniuses over at Thrax CBD for sponsoring this show with their amazing products. Got a link in the description. Also, big thank you to our sponsor, J&J Distribution, Ohio's premier CBD and Delta 8 wholesale supplier. Retailers, check out their brands Kush Burst and 3-Chi THC Edibles. And also want to give a big thank you to our local print shop, Franklinton Press. If you need any custom merch or custom printing, hit them up. They'll take good care of you. We got links in the description. And yeah, much love, y'all. Now back to the show. So here we are today with Ethan Schwartz. Ethan, so glad to have you on here. So for everyone out there listening, Ethan's the promoter behind bringing Umphrey's McGee, the Disco Biscuits, and now Wilco to Iceland. You know, I know you all have seen this. When the pandemic hit, I was at a music venue seeing Pigeons and Goose, and I first found out that shit was hitting the fan because everyone was freaking out that Umphrey's was getting canceled. But anyways, fast forward to now, you know, rolling with the punches. And Ethan's still making it happen, you know, just sold out Wilco today, the day we're recording this. And yeah, a little bit more about Ethan. He's the founder of Florida's Langerado Festival. Hope I pronounced that right. And he also is the production manager for a music cruise company called Sixth Man for years. So that's Ethan's background. Ethan Schwartz. Ethan, man, so glad to have you here. To start this off, I'd love to talk about just like your original vision starting Bucket List Tours.
So for years, it was probably going back to 2007, I was involved in the first a couple of Caribbean holidays. The guy who owns the company that puts those on, he and I were partners in Langerado. And having grown up in South Florida, you know, I was down on this beach with Umphrey's and the Disco Biscuits, and it was awesome. You know, but growing up in South Florida, I'd been to the beach, and really right around this time, I had just seen the Sigur Rós documentary, Haima. And, you know, I'm sitting on the beach with friends of mine, or we're listening to the Disco Biscuits and Umphrey's. And I said, you know, I'd like to take this band, take some of these bands to Iceland, see bands there. You know, that documentary really is just it's an incredible tour around Iceland. And just seeing it just got me really super inspired. You know, for years and years, I talked about it and I'd approached a couple of bands. And it was just kind of, you know, no real action, no bites. I think it was probably in 2016, my current partner, Larry, we were working and putting on Catskill Chill Music Festival in upstate New York. And, you know, late one night after the shows were ended, we're, you know, having an after show drink. And, you know, I brought up the idea of Iceland, and without a second thought, Larry said, I'm in. So literally 6 months later, we were in Iceland. I had made contact with the venue, Harpa, and we were doing a tour of Harpa. And just, you know, fell in love with the place. I'd already been in love with it. I had not been to Iceland yet. And having been over there, and funny enough, you know, when we were walking around the venue, the account manager had said to us, you know, they actually had a band from the United States playing there tonight. They were doing their Reykjavik Jazz Festival. And turns out it was Snarky Puppy. At the time I was living in Athens, and I know Snarky Puppy's monitor engineer. So she walked us into the venue, Eldborg Hall, which is the big red room that we do Umphrey's and Wilco and the Biscuits. And I just walk on stage and I just happened to tap Matt on the shoulder and I said, hey, what's going on, Matt? And he turned around and he's like, what the hell are you doing here? And, you know, we started talking. I told him we were trying to put on these shows. Years later, when we did the Umphrey shows, he was like the first person I had reached out to and told him we were doing these shows. So it's kind of a funny story, but you know, the dream has always been, you know, I've done a lot of stuff. You know, we did Langerado from 2003 to 2008, you know, we grew that from 3,000 people to almost 25,000 people. The last year we had it, with REM and the Beastie Boys, which was, you know, upper level achievement that I could ever imagine. I was doing shows with the Beastie Boys. You know, and traveling around, you know, I've probably spent the last 25 years plus traveling around, seeing fish all over the country, and went to see them in Europe in the summer of 98. And, you know, I just wanted to see some of these other places. And that really became the, you know, the impetus behind this idea that Larry and I are fulfilling right now. So it's just been a really, really incredible experience. You know, I mentioned earlier, you know, the pandemic came around. We had Umphrey's booked. We were about 10 days from doing the shows. And we were watching really, really closely, hoping we can get him in, doing everything we could to get him in. And then, you know, 10 days prior, we had to pull the plug, obviously. You know, we finally got around to doing these shows in March of this year, and it just was absolutely incredible. You know, I've been doing this for a long time, and something always goes wrong. You know, no matter where you are in the United States and in Mexico and the Caribbean and Europe, you know, there's always something that goes wrong. And it was such an incredible experience. We were lucky enough, you know, for 2 years, we were talking to all the Umphrey's fans who were planning on going to the show. You know, had a Facebook group, somebody had created a fan Facebook group. And we just knew all these people. And so what we did was, you know, since everybody was coming for 3 days, we gave out 3 day passes, 3 day wristbands. And literally on the Friday, the first afternoon of the shows, everybody came in to pick up their tickets, and we talked to every single person who came, and they were just having the absolute time of their lives. And I don't know if that had to do with the long 2 year wait or 3 years that we had been planning this event, or just, you know, mostly just being in Iceland. You know, we talked to people who were there 10 days before the shows, people were staying 10 days afterwards. They just made every moment of their time there count. It was really incredible. And then the shows were fantastic. I mean, you know, I won't speak for the Umphrey's guys, but I've heard, you know, from people in their camp that it was one of the, you know, best production experiences they've had. The venue it's a world-class opera house. It sounded incredible. I spent 3 nights, you know, we watched all 3 nights, and I went to try to go to every vantage point in the venue. And it just, It's just an incredible, beautiful venue. I don't know if you've ever seen the picture. There's a great picture of the practice room that looks out the back of Harpa over the bay, over this mountain to the north. It's a picture of Jake just sitting back in a chair with his feet up playing guitar with this just absolutely incredible view in front of him through the glass of Harpa. That's just, it's incredible. And really just, like I said, everybody that we talked to just had a blast. And, you know, they're still active on that Facebook group. You know, when are we going back? When are we going back? So, you know, we're working on some new stuff for Humphreys, you know, and just it's just kind of snowballed into just an incredible, you know, situation we've got going on here. You know, Mark Brownstein from the Disco Biscuits, his side project, Star Kitchen, opened up one of the nights. And, you know, I remember the first night he was there, he came up to me and Larry and he was just like, guys, I had no idea. He's because we talked to him first. Like, I think Mark was one of the first people we talked to about this, you know, just because I'm a Biscuits fan since I saw them at the Wetlands New Year's 98, 99. And, you know, I have done a lot of shows with those guys, all these bands at Langerado, just club shows. And when I started promoting shows in Florida in 2000, and it was just, you know, he was so psyched about being there. I won't speak for him other than, you know, my partner, Larry, took him and I think some of his bandmates on a trip to go explore. I think this was probably the Saturday afternoon of the Humphreys shows. And, you know, Larry's one of the, you know, my partner Larry is probably one of the greatest people on earth. And anybody who knows Larry would say the same thing. And they were in a little rental car going over a glacier or driving around where they probably shouldn't have. And Larry's like, I got it. And gunned it and got stuck in the ice and the snow. And, you know, they managed to call, you know, our partner over there who called him up and just started laughing because, you know, it's like it happens all the time. They got him out, you know, they got back to the venue and Mark was just talking about it, just having, you know, what an incredible experience it was.
Mm. That must feel so like fulfilling to have envisioned that, you know, fast forward post COVID actually goes down.
Yeah, it was awesome. There's actually a really great picture. One of my favorite pictures that somebody took of me and Larry are sitting there. And I was just, you know, after 15 years of, you know, having this idea and this, you know, this vision of making this happen, you know, just seeing that packed room and everybody there. I mean, this particular scene, you know, the jam band scene, you know, we've all seen it. We're so passionate about the bands that we love. You know, I've like when I said earlier, you know, I've seen Fish close to 200 times, traveled all over. I'd say, you know, I've met my wife, I have my daughter because of that band peripherally, my career, you know, and it's all the bands that we love, you know, to be able to do stuff like this is just incredible. And to see it happen in such an amazing way, you know, just really, it made me giddy the whole time we were there.
I'd love to hear you talk about music, but specifically this brand of improvisational music, this, you know, jam bands that you love so much. Like, what about it do you feel like caused you to orient your life around it?
It was just so different than anything I was listening to back when I first, you know, heard Fish. You know, when I was in college in the 90s, you know, I listened to grunge like everybody else. Faith No More was my favorite band, and I still love them. I actually went to go see Fish at the Sunrise Musical Theater in 1994. I didn't go into the show because I had a really awful toothache and I missed like 2 years of shows. I was in Europe doing my last 6 credits of college in Prague in the summer of 96. And people who I was studying with went to Germany to go see Fish. And for some reason, I didn't go with them. And this is when they were touring with Santana. They were probably playing in a club that's the size of my house. And I finally got to see them at Coral Sky, 11/2/96. And, you know, I was just blown away the first time I saw them. It was just everything about it, you know, musically, it hit every note for me. You know, my brother took me to see the Grateful Dead when I was 14. I had a great time, but I don't think I got it when I was that age. And then I saw them again when I was in college and, you know, I had a good time, but it really wasn't what I was listening to. From the moment I heard Fish, I got it. And, you know, started touring, seeing a bunch of shows, went to Europe in the summer of 98, you know, living in Florida at the time, South Florida, there were not a lot of these bands coming down. So my friends and I would drive up to Jacksonville from Fort Lauderdale or Gainesville to see shows. And really there's two points that I can pinpoint that really got me into the business. One was going up to Jacksonville. We saw Mo, this is probably sometime in 1999. And some way or another, we'd met Al and, you know, had become friendly with Al somehow from seeing shows, maybe driving up to Atlanta in different times. And we were talking to him about, you know, how come you guys won't come down to South Florida? And he said, you know, when there's a promoter who's willing to bring us down there, we'll come down there. And this is probably, you know, fall of 1999. And then New Year's 2000, Fish did Big Cypress. And I remember specifically driving out of there on January 1st, 2000, and saying to my girlfriend, my wife at the time now, saying, I want to do something out here. And I'd never thrown a party at my parents' house. It's just not my thing. I didn't do it. And me and my best friend, 2 weeks later, he started calling bands and, you know, saying, hey, you want to come down to Florida? And I think our first show was like middle of February in 2000. So like 6 weeks later, we paid a band 100% of the door. We had no idea what we were doing. I think 17 people came to the show, but it was awesome. It was such an incredible experience. And, you know, my friend Scott at the time just started calling all these bands and getting these bands to come down to Florida. And we just kind of created this kind of mini jam band scene in South Florida. You know, after a year, Scott got into some other things, and I just, you know, I loved seeing shows. You know, I loved seeing the shows, and we just started doing more and more. After about 2 years, I met my partner in Langerado, Mark. And, you know, I knew he had come from the Richmond area and had done festivals, smaller festivals on, I think, Browns Island. And I said, you want to put on a jam band festival? And he's like, yeah, let's do it. And we started putting on this festival. And the funny thing is, you know, prior to that, I'd been approached by the Fort Lauderdale Blues Festival, you know, about helping them out with some programming. And one of the writers for one of the local weekly magazines had wrote a op-ed piece about, you know, we don't need these bands in our festival. You know, this is going to ruin the Blues Festival. And I wrote him back and I said, you know, how is having the North Mississippi All-Stars that's going to bring in a whole bunch of new people who aren't familiar with the bands that currently, you know, that play at the Blues Festival, how's that a bad thing? And he said, you know what, if you want a jam band festival, put one on yourself. So challenge accepted. And, you know, from there we built it up. The first year, like I said earlier, we did about 3,000 people. It was a single day event and just kept growing every year until that last year we did it at Big Cypress in 2008. You know, when I had the Beastie Boys, REM, Phil Lesh and Friends, and 80 other acts, and about 25,000 people. It's just, you know, mind-blowing to be able to get to that point.
So, Ethan, with leading festivals, you know, leading the production, all the marketing, all of it, I'm curious what you've learned are the most important attributes and intangibles of a great leader.
I find my talents to be, you know, especially when I was working for Six Man, to be delegating. You know, I'll be completely honest, I got really good advice from the production manager who was there before me, because I came into that position with zero production experience. I'd never pushed a case, you know, I never plugged anything in. And I started working there. And the advice that I got was, you know, you've got these people who work for you who know what they're doing. Let them do their jobs. You know, they know what they're doing. They know more about plugging in stuff and sound than you do. Let them do their jobs. If you've got ideas and thoughts, certainly speak up and say, hey, can we do this? And they're either going to say, yes, we can do this, or they're going to say, no, we can't do this, and here's why. And I found that in the 7 years that I was there, I think I did 85 cruises. And I go back and look at, you know, what we started with. When I started working there to what we built it up to over those 7 years, and you know, the type of acts that we started doing, you know, so without a doubt, being able to find the right people who know what they're doing and trusting in them and letting them do their jobs is the key to success in that business, in that festival business, without a doubt. There's plenty of amazing people, you know, there's plenty of amazing people who work in festivals who know what they're doing. And if you let them do their job, you're going to be successful. Mm.
So, you know, looking back, how challenging the past couple of years have been for events, festivals, even now, still like huge challenge. I'm curious what you think the future of live events and festival looks like how you think it'll evolve the next 5, 10, 15 years.
You know, probably like everybody else, I think there's a glut of festivals, you know. It's very hard to create a new festival idea. If you do, you're very lucky and you're going to be successful. I think, you know, there's very few headliners nowadays, I guess. You know, a lot of the festivals probably have very similar lineups. I was actually working for years prior to the pandemic on trying to do another festival out of Big Cypress. And I had met with the Seminole Tribe and we got really far along in the process. You know, I think the last meeting I had was the end of February in 2020. And then everything obviously got shut down. You know, and then midway through the summer, I happened to be reading Rolling Stone magazine with some festival lineups. And I said, you know, as much as I love putting together festival lineups, I don't know any of the acts that are on these festivals nowadays. I don't know if I've aged out. You know, I consider myself pretty up on music, but you know, there's so many different acts that are, you know, festivals have, you know, 100 acts on them, and I don't know any of them. You know, I barely knew any of them. I just went to work at Bonnaroo this past summer, and I think there was 150 acts on the bill. I probably knew 20% of them. It's just that there's so much new music coming out there. It's hard, you know, unless you're really digging into it, it's hard to really keep track of so much of this stuff. So, you know, obviously EDM is a huge portion of it. You know, and unless you have somebody that's keeping up with that, you know, it's really hard to be unique. I think more and more festivals are going to come and go. You know, you'll always have Coachella and Lollapalooza that are going to be there forever. But I think, you know, whereas, you know, 10 years ago, you had to travel to a lot of festivals, now there's festivals in your backyard. So, I mean, you know, one of the things that terrifies me about festivals right now is what happened, you know, in Atlanta this summer with Music Midtown. You know, that's a festival that's been going on for 25, 30 years. And it was canceled over, you know, one guy, you know, wants to bring his gun to the festival. And, you know, if things can get turned around that easily by one person, then, you know, I don't necessarily know if that's something, you know, I want to get back into or be involved with at this point. I think what, you know, what we've got going on with, I don't want to call them destination events, because whereas, you know, if you go to a resort, you know, you're kind of told, hey, you can check into the resort this day, you can check out of the resort on this day. We're kind of just saying, hey, come when you want, leave when you want, you can eat where you want, you can travel wherever you want to do and stay as long as you want. So, you know, I think eventually there will be a, you know, a breaking point with festivals. You see it happen now where, you know, it was a couple of maybe 5 or 6 years ago, there was a whole slew of festivals that got canceled. You know, and I think it's a lot of that, you know, caused a lot of ticketing companies to change how they do business. You know, it caused a lot of bands to change how they do business as far as, you know, asking for deposits up front, or bigger deposits up front from newer, you know, newer promoters or promoters who don't necessarily have that track record. So, you know, who knows where it's going to go in the next couple of years, you know, but there's tons of them popping up, you know, every weekend, in every major market, in every B market, in every C market. And bands certainly, you know, through no fault of the bands, you know, that they're going to take that money that's offered for festivals, and they should.
Well, Ethan, definitely cool to hear your perspective. You know, definitely, I very much admire what you've been able to do. And, you know, it's easy to have an idea, but it takes a very special, you know, energy to make an idea happen. Ethan Schwartz, Bucket List Tours, round of applause. Final question for you. Okay. So you're in charge of running the production. All of a sudden, shit hits the fan. I'm curious what your self-talk and what your like approach is in that moment where it's just like code red.
I mean, obviously the most important thing when you're dealing with, you know, any sort of crowd is the safety of, you know, the crowd and the band and your team. So first and foremost, you know, depending on what it is, you know, whether God forbid, you know, an active shooter situation, you know, the safety is paramount. So, you know, when you're talking about big events, you know, the last big event that I was really super involved in was, you know, Langerado as far as a big time event. And, you know, our main security guy had been Fish's security guy for years and years. And, you know, it goes back to, you know, what I said earlier, that he knows a lot more about security stuff and taking care of a crowd and taking care of band and taking care of the staff. So when he tells me something's got to be done, you got to stop the show. You know, you got to pull the plug. You got to get those guys off stage. You got to get everybody to their cars. I listen to him. I'm not going to override him on that. You know, we've seen too many things happen in the last few years, you know, natural and unnatural disasters at festivals, that is ultimately the most important aspect is keeping, you know, the crowds and the bands and the production staff safe. So that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Ethan Schwartz, Bucket List Tours. We got link in the description to check out what they've got going on. Wilco just sold out. Stay tuned for future announcements from then. Ethan, man, so glad to have you here.
Appreciate it, Cam. Thank you.